20, Book 2, The Gardener's Dog, in which colonialism's omnivorous sense of entitlement is made in the name of efficiency while it fetishizes authenticity or puts it on display in safe spaces.
21. In 2009, ex-president of Peru, Alan Garcia, justified an executive decree allowing the taking of land by foreign corporations. By describing his indigenous fellow citizens opposing such grabs as a gardener's dog. They do not only eat from the garden, but they will also prevent others from eating. Such land grabs have continued and are violent.
22. Tradition is a plaything for treasonable clerks. Useful for social cohesion, especially the invented variety, or for authenticity claim-making, but a repressive anachronism when giving cohesion to communal resistance against natural resource or land grabbing by their masters. Confucius and Confucian ideology has been encouraged by the Chinese Communist Party in recent years as gross inequality in the country becomes the norm. Its mix of passive social cohesion and acceptance of one's place fits the times and the needs of the party. Its leader, as of November 2012, Xi Jinping, became the first one to participate in the commemoration of Confucius's birthday. At the International Confucian Association in 2014, he said, "To understand today's China, today's Chinese people, we must understand Chinese culture and blood and nourish Chinese people's grasp of its own cultural soil."
23. Eduardo Galeano, Faces and Masks, 1987. In 1808, by the will of the Portuguese prince recently arrived in Brazil, the traditional burning of Judases during the Holy Week is to be banned in the colony. To avenge Christ and avenge themselves, the people would throw on the fire one night in the year, the marshal and the archbishop, the rich merchant, the big landlord, the chief of police. The naked ones have enjoyed seeing how the rag dolls, sumptuously adorned and filled with firecrackers, twist in pain and explode amid the flames. From now on, those in power will not suffer even in Holy Week.
24. In its hybrid condition, heritage generates a modernized version, i.e. homologated and normalized, of past traditional culture. The World Heritage List was started by UNESCO in 1978. At present, there are 700 sites with more to be added. However, what clearly stands out is that Western cultural heritage, or that which is linked with the Christian civilization, is predominant. Moreover, the concept of cultural heritage itself is a product of modern Western culture and, like the nationalist ideology to which it is closely linked, it has not stopped globalizing since the 19th century. Which has generated a mimesis in the colonial territories that gained independence, an example of the westernizing project which hides behind the cosmopolitan ideology of enlightened origin. Gil Manuel Hernandez y Martí, The Deterritorialization of Cultural Heritage, 2006.
25. Tradition is the enemy of progress. Sign at the entry to schools of the U.S. Department of the Interior's Bureau of Indian Affairs on Navajo Reservation, 1950s to 1960s.
26. Annual report of the Commissioner of Indian Affairs to the Secretary of Interior, USA, 1866.
The only way to civilize the Indian is to let him out into the sunshine and tell him what the sunshine is for and what the rain comes for and when to put his seed into the ground.
27.
The late 19th century theorist of colonial rule, Henry Maine, took kinship to be the central fact of primitive society. Yet the more attentive he became to the local and customary, the more he confined the native in a separate conceptual domain, shut off from the world of the settler by a fundamental distinction between stationary and progressive societies. Culture was cloistered and unchanging in the non-West, transformative and progressive in the West. Native tradition, it followed, was a triumph of locality over time. Mahmoud Mamdami, What is a Tribe, 2012.
28. Despotism is a legitimate mode of government in dealing with barbarians, provided the end be their improvement. John Stuart Mill. On Liberty and Other Writings.
29. The 2000 to 2008 Botswana government of President Festus Mohai had as a policy the forcible removal of the Barasawai, also known as the Sand People and sometimes called Bushmen, from the Kalahari Desert, where they have always lived. This is for the benefit of private enterprise, tourism, and diamond mining. The president, calling them primitives from the Stone Age, has said they should not be allowed to continue living like animals in game parks. They deserve a decent life. They need to go to schools, have better health care. They cannot be allowed to live a primitive life while other Botswana citizens are enjoying the fruits of modernity. At the same time, the Hoodia plant, used by the long-time residents of the desert, has been recognized as a successful hunger suppressant and is now much advertised by the alternative health product market as an aid to dieting without the need for willpower. Already in 2000, while talking of a potential 2 billion euro market, Dr. Richard Dixie, who was developing the market, said that though they wanted to pay the Bushmen back for discovering the plant, they were being extinguished and their intellectual property rights therefore ignored, a case of biopiracy. They could starve to make Westerners thin. In 2013, the new Sandhurst-trained president, Ian Khama, began to stop the desert residents from digging boreholes for water while allowing this privilege to wildlife safaris, thus continuing the policy of wiping them out by enclosure of their land.
30. Moritz Thompson, Living Poor, 1969. Since in the past all change has been for the worse for poor black Ecuadorians, they resist all change now.
31. The land of Palestine is waiting for a cultural, industrious people. Enriched by material and spiritual resources, armed with the weapon of science and technology, the country craves for this people to come and settle in it, bloom its arid mountains, fertilize its uncultivated land, forest its sands, and the deserted country will become heaven. The Jews, as can already be seen in their agricultural colonies, will introduce to the land improved tools, updated agricultural methods, and develop the land's drainage and transportation systems. David Ben-Gurion, HaTorin, Issue 5, 1915.
32. In settler colonialism, the need of settlers to make moral sense of dispossessing indigenous peoples permanently of their land in favour of settler ownership inspires locally tailored myths about why the native peoples not only lack any legitimate claim to terra nullius, but must be excluded from the hope of ever sharing sovereignty, which might reintroduce their right to get their land back. A canon of standard devices is enlisted to this end. For example, social Darwinist logic proposing the native people's permanently inferior cultural status relative to the settler society, evidenced by, among other things, their very defeat. Virginia Tilley, Have We Passed the Tipping Point, 2007.
33. The historicization of the Bible is a national enterprise. The Israeli Defense Force has even published a complete chronology of biblical events, giving exact dates for the creation of the world, the killing of Abel and the exodus from Egypt. Benjamin Beit Halami, 2008. The production of a nano version of the Bible, in turn, demonstrates Israel's claims of modern world superiority, while the claims made by Ben-Gurion having been facilitated by the grabbing of Palestinian water, the West Bank's mountain aquifer. Israel's illegal settlements take about 80% of the aquifer's flow.
34. Reductions of the city to physical morphology in the USA Army Field Manual on Urban Operations, FM 306/2006, has three powerful effects. First, they render the city as an uninhabited space, shot through with violence, yet without a body in sight. This repeats the colonial gesture of terra nullius, in which the city becomes a vacant space awaiting its possession. Its emptiness works to convey a right to be there on those who represent it thus. Second, they are performative. As John Pickles shows, mapping, even as it claims to be representing the world, produces it. Third, these representations have legitimating force. They circulate through public spheres to prepare audiences for war and desensitize them to its outcomes. The reduction of the city to a visual field is naturalized through the media barrage of satellite images and bombsite views, city as target, and through representations that hollow out the city on the ground. Derek Gregory, The Rush to the Intimate, 2008.
35. Colonialism rests on devaluing traditional lifeways as unproductive, inefficient, irrational, static, unhistoric, timeless, marginal, slavishly dependent on nature, lacking in codified property rights that incentive enterprise. Russian Foreign Minister Alexander Gorchakov in 1864 justified colonizing Kazakhs by saying, "When civilized states are brought into contact with half-savage nomad populations, possessing no fixed social organization, it always happens that the more civilized state is forced to exercise a certain ascendancy over those whom their turbulent and unsettled character make them most undesirable neighbors." Gabriel Latif, Spoiling Tibet, 2013.
36. In the late 18th century, Thomas Barnard, a British engineer working in India, studied 800 villages there and found the average production of paddy rice to be 3,600 kilograms per hectare, with the most productive 130 villages averaging 8,200 kilograms. This is higher than the average yields two centuries later, when the 1960s Green Revolution was being proclaimed as a symbol of modernity in a backward world, with the promise of an end to hunger globally, which was to be achieved not with the intercropping and optimal seed selection noted by Barnard, but by water, fertilizer, and pesticide-heavy monocropping.
37. Robert Beale, The New Imperialism, 2000. The scientific approach to agriculture has historically signified taking knowledge from the direct producers and turning it into an instrument of tyranny over them.
38. The USA and the United Fruit Company finally succeeded in overthrowing the Guatemalan government of Jacobo Arbenz with an invasion force in 1954. In addition to establishing labor rights, its crime was agrarian reform that annoyed the company and was labeled communist. Indigenous Mayan peasants not only challenged land enclosures by the company, but found a newfound appetite for thinking and talking. The CIA was given a large budget for the coup and turned to Madison Avenue advertising agencies, pop sociologists, and the literature of mass psychology to create the illusion of mass opposition to Arbenz. Internally, the Catholic Church was emboldened to say the Cold War was won between the city of God and the city of the devil incarnate. The Arbenz supporters, it said, were professional corruptors of the feminine soul, elevating women with gifts of proselytism or leadership to high positions in official bureaucracy. And if the local hierarchy was too fastidious for the pocuteur, they had Spanish fascist priests who cried, "We do not want a cold Catholicism. We want holiness, ardent, great and joyous holiness, intransigent and fanatical." The Madison Avenue gloss was that their coup would prevent a white terror.
39. Evil and the devil were much used by the Spanish invaders of the Americas in the repression of indigenous culture. It has re-entered the political vocabulary. In the early days of the Iranian Revolution, November 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini named the USA as the Great Satan. The rhetorical retaliation had to wait some years, until in 2002, President George W. Bush named some countries, including Iran, as an axis of evil. His UN spokesman thus labeled still more countries, including Cuba. In 2014, Patriarch Filiat of the Kiev Orthodox Church announced that Vladimir Putin had fallen under the spell of Satan. In the same year, Russia's leading state-run broadcaster accused the Ukrainian prime minister of links with a satanic religious sect that aims to destroy the Russian Orthodox Church. The South African president, Jacob Zuma, facing corruption charges, asks folk to pray for politicians who have been derailed by Satan. Gay people are satanic, according to Gambia's president, Yahya, and other African leaders invoking bogus African tradition.
40. Accounts of and the fear of human bodies being plundered for their fat by pishtacos have existed in Peru for more than 500 years. They didn't come out of nowhere. Fat was used by Spanish invaders for healing wounds and as a cure for arthritis. A priest in 1571 described indigenous people near Cusco as being afraid to deliver firewood to a Spanish house for fear of being killed for the fat to be then used as a cure for foreign sickness. In the 1950s, the story was that Christian monks themselves stole it for fuel for altar lamps or to grease church bells. During the Sendero Luminoso revolt from 1980 to 95, it too was accused of having pishtacos in its midst. Then more sophisticated fat thieves were believed to kill for its use in lubricating industrial machinery or to provide food for special restaurants frequented by members of the armed forces. Pishtacos disguised themselves as white doctors, sometimes with black assistants, carrying identity cards given to them by the then President Alan Garcia. Indeed, a group of medics was almost lynched in 1989. 41. In 2015, a murky Bolly story emerged, according to which Peru's national chief displayed an Inca cola bottle, which he claimed was filled with human fat, taken by a criminal gang for use by the European cosmetic industry. Though the Bolly story was full of holes, the bottle did indeed contain human grease.
42. U.S. gay porn star turned ex-gay Christian fundamentalist Joseph Chiabara talked about the devil and why he loves anal sex. I do believe that it creates a doorway, literally, into the demonic. While Massachusetts attorney Daniel Avila claims the scientific evidence of how same-sex attraction most likely may be created provides a credible basis for a spiritual explanation that indicts the devil.
43. In 1975, the white-skinned Miss Guatemala, Emmy Abascal, won the Best National Costume Award at the Miss Universe competition with a traditional Mayan huipil tunic. At the same time, the Guatemalan state was systematically murdering indigenous villagers who, by the early 1980s, had abandoned Mayan clothing altogether on the grounds that it made them a potential target of army violence. But even wearing non-indigenous clothing was no guarantee. When Bolivian migrant workers go to Argentina to work in the sweatshops of Buenos Aires, they take off their everyday, quotes unquote, indigenous clothing to wear secondhand Western outfits and resume their own clothes on return visits to their villages. Mayan women were allowed to participate in an indigenous, quotes unquote, pageant, which from the late 1970s was financed by Romero Lucas García, under whose presidency 400 villages were destroyed, 50,000 killed, and 1 million Mayan people displaced. It fitted the perverse rhetoric the Guatemalan military used against international human rights criticisms, that they think they can tell us what to do because we are Indians.
44 to 45. The look to exotic representations derived from ethnography was used to understand better the crisis and discontents of modern civilization. Today, the Indian must dress as an Indian for the tourist trade in order to participate in capitalism. Nestor Cianclini. In 19th century Argentina, it was the gaucho rather than the Indian, subjected to mass killing, who is the authentic while their actual lifestyles collided with capital accumulation and land enclosure. Those who didn't get employment as farm laborers would be condemned as vagrants or delinquents. The image was the nomadic gaucho who owned the land and wild cattle wherever he laid his head. But he only became a national symbol after the fences went up in the name of private property and the freedom of the world lost in the 1870s. In 1921 to 1922, farm laborers themselves were subject to executions by the Argentine army when they struck against the sheep farming oligopoly of Patagonia.
46. The 1745 uprising, a defeated second attempt to restore a Scottish king, Bonnie Prince Charlie, was a turning point for Scottish Highlanders. Until then, they had been feared as dangerous rebels despite an earlier defeat in 1715. But after 1746, they combined the romance of a primitive people with the charm of an endangered species and were picked up by the romantic movement of the early 19th century. A ban was instituted on distinctive Scottish clothing. After the repeal of the ban, peasants saw no reason to return to the traditional plaid from the trousers they were now wearing. But it became the fashion for anglicised Scottish peers, improving gentry, well-educated Edinburgh lawyers, and Aberdeen merchants who were not constrained by poverty, and who would never have to skip over bogs or lie in heather all night, to exhibit themselves publicly, not in the trews, tartan trousers, the traditional costume of their class, nor in the cumbrous belted plaid, but in a costly and fanciful version of that recent innovation, the filberg, or small kilt. Hugh Trevor Roper, The Invention of Tradition, 1992.
47. The Highland way of life was finally finished off in the 19th century, this time by sheep. We have heard but a few voices against the necessity of removing the former possessors to make way for shepherds, the necessity of reducing the population in order to introduce valuable improvements, and the advantages of committing the soil to the hands of a few have been discussed by men much more capable of doing justice to those subjects than myself, said one beneficiary of the Highland clearances, which involved the burning of the homes of the indigenous. John Preble, The Highland Clearances, 1961.
48. London's Great Exhibition of 1851 created a precedent for world exhibitions in Europe's colonial states and later the USA. Their showcasing of the non-Western world had a familiar pattern to exoticize the primitive and highlight its backwardness. The former might have direct results, as in the case of the painter Paul Gauguin, one of 28 million visitors to the Paris Exposition Universelle of 1889. One of its three major sites was the colonial exhibit with its colonial villages, as in Java, Senegal, and Indochina, all of which were designed by French commissioners to show France's right to colonize. Gauguin visited it many times, and it prompted his eventual journey to Tahiti. From Tahiti, he was soon writing to August Strindberg in Europe in narcissistic cliches of Orientalism of a, quote, clash between your civilization and my barbarism. A civilization from which you are suffering. A barbarism which spells rejuvenation for me. Cited in Alison Moorhead, Understanding and Translation, Gauguin and Strindberg, 2014. 49. Such colonial world fairs continued into the 20th century, with one in Brussels, 1948. In 2005, an African village in Augsburg, Germany was created. The French Exposition Coloniale had African villages, which contrived to show both collective life and the thrill of the jungle. They were reconstructed through the efforts of African and New Caledonian schoolteachers and civil servants enrolled to pose as authentic savages. In the famous L'Afrique Fantôme of Michel Leary, the complaint was that Africans were not exotic enough, but all too ordinary and pragmatic. For the last 20 years, the Austrian multimedia artist André Heller has re-exoticized the Magic Continent with his Africa, Africa successful circus tent shows. Quote, now Heller and his team of choreographers, decorators, lighting designers, and masterful artists have created an opulent and fast-paced version of Africa, Africa for the stage. This new show combines the stellar artistic moments of the original circus tent show with visionary, breathtaking, hitherto unseen attractions that were conceived in a rich variety of locations on the Magic Continent.
50.
Prompted by the future USA President William H. Taft, then the governor of the Philippines, the 1904 St. Louis World Fair featured over 1,000 Filipinos in a native village. Taft, who was to say, the whole hemisphere will be ours, in fact by the superiority of our race, it is already ours morally, wanted them used to justify the USA's civilizing mission in the Philippines that the USA had just occupied. One indigenous group, the Igorots, who occasionally ate dog, were fed with it every day as if this was their normal diet. This was not mere essentialism, but a falsification intended to stigmatize, dog eating being regarded as profoundly dirty on the grounds that the dog will eat anything.
This is not the dog's point of view. My side hurts like hell, and I can see what's going to become of me. Tomorrow it'll break out in ulcers, and then how can I make them heal? In summer you can go and roll in Solanke Park, where there's a special grass that does you good. Besides, you can get a free meal of sausage ends, and there's plenty of greasy bits of food wrapping to lick. But where can I go now? I could easily get pneumonia. And if I get that, citizens, I'll die of hunger. Who's going to run around the dustbins looking for food for a sick bachelor dog? I shall get a chill on my lungs, crawl on my belly till I'm so weak that it'll only need one poke from someone's stick to finish me off. And then the dustman will pick me up by the legs and sling me onto their cart. Dustmen are the lowest form of proletarian life. Humans' rubbish is the filthiest stuff there is. Mikhail Bulgakov, Heart of a Dog, 1925.
52. The force feeding of the Ingorod aroused no criticism, but the near nakedness and wildness of the dancers were too much, and they were all issued with the pink silk trouser pants, which in turn evoked ridicule. The use of the dog to humiliate has continued to be US practice, as revealed in the Abu Ghraib prison and the pink pants in some homeland jails.
53. In archived letters between the North American invaders, Colonel Henry Bouquet and General Amherst, it was suggested that they distribute blankets to, quotes unquote, inoculate the Indians and to try every other method that can serve to extirpate this execrable race. They were also thinking about the use of dogs to hunt down Indians, but did not execute this plan because there weren't enough dogs. The long-standing smallpox epidemic that occurred in the Americas in the 18th and 19th century killed about 90% of the American Indian population, a disease that had a vaccine.